Due to technical difficulties, there are unrecorded portions of this oral argument.
Appellant's counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Rick Krauthammer. I represent Keith Barnett. This is a criminal case out of the Western District of North Carolina. It's a drug case. The lone issue in the case is whether the district court properly enhanced Mr. Barnett's total offense level for maintaining a premises for the purpose of distributing or manufacturing controlled substances. The facts of the case are relatively straightforward. The police learned that drugs were being distributed or sold out of and around a residence on Calvary Drive in Gastonia, North Carolina, which is near Charlotte. They recruited a confidential informant familiar with the residence. He knew the gentleman who lived there, who was a gentleman named Rodney Rhodes. He had also met another gentleman in the driveway of the residence, and that was Mr. Barnett, my client. Mr. Barnett gave him his card one day and said, call him if he needed drugs. And so the police had this confidential informant set up a drug deal with Mr. Barnett at the residence. The confidential informant went there and conducted the deal. He testified at trial. It's unclear where exactly the transaction took place. The confidential informant doesn't say they were inside the house or outside the house. He doesn't say he saw Mr. Barnett come out of the house. Mr. Barnett testified later in the trial and said, yeah, that's me in those photos, but that I'm just sitting there at the picnic table. I don't actually give the guy any drugs. So from that, you can infer that it was probably at a picnic table outside the house somewhere. Anyway, based on the controlled by purchase, which was audio and videotaped, the police got a search warrant for the house, and they executed that warrant on October 9th, 2017. They drove up to the house in a raid style fashion, and Mr. Barnett was standing out front of the house. He immediately ran inside the house, and then a few seconds later, he ran out a side door of the house and attempted to hop over of heroin in it. They arrested him, and he ultimately decided to go to trial. Two other witnesses testified at the trial and said that they lived in the neighborhood or were familiar with the neighborhood. One of them said that he bought drugs from Mr. Rhodes. They both said that they had never bought drugs from Mr. Barnett, but they would see him outside the house engaging in transactions. Both of them said that Mr. Barnett did not live there, but he would always be there. One of them said that on one occasion he drove up to the house, stayed in his car. He gave Mr. Barnett some drugs. Mr. Barnett took the drugs inside the house and then came back outside the house with the money and gave the gentleman the money, and the gentleman drove away. And so that was.
Can I ask a couple of quick questions to make sure I understand, because it's a lot of record and y'all know it a lot better than we do. There were, in addition to the drugs over the fence, there were drugs found in the house.
Correct.
Right. And for sentencing purposes, your client, those drugs were attributed to your client as part of the conspiracy.
Correct.
At sentencing, right?
So right.
And just so I understand, that's because maybe it's not expressly set out, but it's because they were, you know, foreseeable to him and within the scope of the conspiracy, right? The same language you hear all the time.
Correct.
Right. So the question I've got is, why doesn't that same standard, we can call it Pinkerton, we can call it relevant conduct, if his co-defendant, Mr. Rhodes, imagine hypothetically, it was only his house, he is the only one that maintained it, and he only sold drugs out of it, and your client never did, but your client knew all about it and was a co-conspirator with him, right? Then the maintenance of a drug house would be, you know, foreseeable to your client, right? And within the scope of the conspiracy, right? Because they've got a drug conspiracy. And so I guess what I'm wondering is why it matters. Like, I think it's easy to say that Mr. Rhodes maintained a drug house. I don't think you would dispute that aspect, or at least
I do not dispute that.
And so why wouldn't we simply say under Pinkerton type analysis at sentencing that because his maintenance was foreseeable to Mr. Barnett and within the scope of the conspiracy, the drug conspiracy, that he gets the 2-point enhancement for the same reasons he gets the attribution of the drugs that were found in the house.
So what you're talking about is conspiracy theory applied to the premises enhancement. Right. And that has, it's rare, but it has been looked at a few times in the case law. There is a Eighth Circuit case. It's United States v. Miller, which cites United States versus Patton, I believe. And basically, the Eighth Circuit, the holding is that the Eighth Circuit assumed that Section 2D1.1B12, which is the premises enhancement guideline, requires proof that the specific defendant being sentenced maintained the premises for the purpose of drug manufacture or distribution. The court explained that it is not sufficient that others possess the requisite purpose. And so United States v. Payton, 636 F3rd 1027, Eighth Circuit 2011 is the case where that emanated from. On the other hand, there is the United States versus Holmes, an 11th Circuit case, which held that nothing in 2D1.1B12 prohibits a sentencing court from imposing the premises enhancement based on jointly undertaking criminal activity, because unlike other sections of the guidelines where jointly undertaken criminal activity cannot be considered during sentencing, 2D1.1B12 lacks an application note limiting its effect, or limiting the effect of Section 1B1.3A1B, which is talks about conspiracy liability. And so those are kind of the two competing cases. There are some, so basically it's a split. And there's a case out of Indiana, Northern District of Indiana. The site is United States versus Lewis, 2020, U.S. District, Lexus, 41691, that discusses these two cases with a similar case that judge was entertaining. And that particular judge sided with the 11th Circuit and said, I don't see anything in the guidelines that limits 2D1.1B12 in terms of applying conspiracy theory to that to that particular enhancement. There's another case out of Northern District of Indiana where a different judge found the opposite and says, I can find no appellate cases out of our jurisdiction that say you can apply conspiracy theory to that enhancement, and I'm not going to do it. I'm going to stick with the plain meaning of the language in the enhancement, and he did not apply it. So those are the kind of the two competing theories as far as the conspiracy theory being applied to that particular enhancement. And I'm urging the court to obviously to take the Eighth Circuit approach and not apply it, not apply conspiracy theory to the enhancement. In terms of the facts, well, in terms of the guideline itself, you know, it simply reads that if the defendant maintained a premises for the purposes of manufacturing or distributing a controlled substance, increases total offense level by 2 levels. Application note 17 of that guideline talks about the application of the guideline. It says it applies to a defendant who knowingly maintains a premises for the purpose of manufacturing or distributing controlled substances, including storage of controlled substances for distribution. And then it says, among the factors the court should consider are A, whether the defendant held a possessory interest in the premises, i.e. owned or rented it, and B, the extent to which the defendant controlled access to or activities at the premises. And so the case law in the Fourth Circuit has developed such that the Fourth Circuit considers it a fact-specific inquiry that considers the totality of the circumstances. So, for example, there's 3 cases that are similar. In United States versus Clark, 665 Federal Appendix 298, 2016. The apartment was owned by others. Clark lived out of state. She did not have a key to the apartment. However, the court still found that she controlled the premises because she had access. She stayed at the apartment at times. She had access to the interior of the apartment. And importantly, she participated in the rampant drug activity within the apartment. and thus she controlled the premises or maintained them for drug-related purposes. Likewise, in United States versus Christian, 544 Federal Appendix 188, 2013. Yes, ma'am.
So why isn't that pretty similar to what we have here? I know none of these cases are going to be exactly the same on the facts. We don't have owning or renting the premises, but if the it's a very, as you said, a very fact intense inquiry, and there was evidence that if the district court believed it, that there were, there's a large quantity of drugs found in the house. Your client at least once, was engaged in a, if you believe certain testimony, engaged in a drug transaction that involved portioning out some drugs from the drugs at the house to sell to someone. And there was lots of testimony that he was constantly selling drugs, or regularly selling drugs, up and down Calvary Street. And that if someone couldn't get in touch with Rhodes for their drugs from the house, they would get in touch with him. So there's drugs stored at the house with his knowledge and his use of them, for controlling activities, the activity being selling drugs, in and around the house. Why, if a district court believed
he's inside the house, other than the day he was arrested when he ran in the house and then quickly ran back out. And my take on that,
you said, so he's in the house on that day. Of course, he testified he was at a picnic table, but at the drug sale that was on video. But of course, it was on video, and other people testified that he was at the side of the house at the door. And then there's someone who said that he was basically kind of Rhodes' second in command. Which would certainly suggest that he had access to the premises to control, access to the drugs. So again, that's testimony both ways, but if the district court couldn't he find by preponderance of the evidence that there's enough here?
Well, to be fair to you, Your Honor, the guideline does say you look at the extent to which he controlled activities at the premises, and not necessarily in the premises, but the case law has come down such that they looked at defendants who, although they didn't own the residence or have a key to the residence, they were inside the residence and controlling what was going on inside the residence. And so my argument is that there's very little evidence of Barnett inside the house. All of what he's doing is outside the house. And I look at it not so much as how the government characterized it, which was that he was a partner in crime with Rodney Rhodes. I look at it as more like an employer-employee relationship, as if he were Rhodes's employee doing Rhodes's bidding. It's Rhodes' house, and it was Rhodes' purpose to maintain the residence for manufacture of drug distribution, not necessarily Barnett's purpose. So if I believe if the court is going to rule against Mr. Barnett, they need to do, as Judge Richardson suggested, do so under maybe a conspiracy theory liability and say, well, we're going to take the Eighth Circuit's approach and say, he was a conspirator to Rhodes. Rhodes maintained the premises for manufacture of drug distribution. Therefore, the enhancement applies to Barnett also. But in terms of whether or not there was proof that Barnett's purpose was to maintain that residence for drug distribution or manufacture, I argue that the evidence is insufficient. And, there's evidence he's there, he's engaging in drug activities, but not necessarily that he's relying on the premises for the purpose of engaging in his drug activities. So that's my response to that question.
What do you do about him running stored?
I'm sorry, whose question should I answer?
Sorry, I just asked as a follow-up, you said there's no evidence he was relying on the premises. And I just asked, where were the drugs stored that he sold?
Well, that's my argument is that they were on his person. So he ran in the house and then he ran back out and then he tried to jump a fence. And then on the other side of the fence, they found some drugs in a bag. My argument is that's his drugs that are in the bag, not necessarily the drugs that are inside the house that belong to Rodney Rhodes.
What about the drugs he sold, other than on the one day, the other testimony about drug transactions?
There's no evidence on where he got those drugs. There's no evidence that he went inside the house, got the drugs, brought them back out and sold them. He may have brought them there on his person. So it's an insufficiency of evidence argument. And it's
so
it's
why isn't the fact that he turned and ran back into the house probably the worst fact in this case for this argument, that he's just basically an independent contractor who works for somebody who runs this house. But then the police show up and his first instinct is to turn and run into the house. Why isn't that bad? And what do you say about that fact?
Because the house is at the end of a street and there's nowhere else to go. So he's trying to get away from the police. His instinct is to run into the house to get away from him. He's in there a few seconds, realizes that's a bad idea, runs back out of the house and tries to jump a fence and is unsuccessful and he's caught. So that's my answer to that. So that's my time on opening. I'll yield to the government. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel?
May it please the court, Anthony Enright for the United States. I'd like to begin by answering Judge Richardson's question, which is that he can appropriately be held responsible. Pinkerton-style conspiratorial liability. There you have the act. You have a jointly undertaken activity, and it's reasonably foreseeable conduct in furtherance of that activity, because he certainly knew about the house, and it was reasonably foreseeable. Also because Barnett aided and abetted Rhodes' maintenance of the stash house. Even if this court were to assume that the evidence doesn't establish Barnett's direct maintenance of that stash house. And
do you agree with the friend? Do you agree with your friend on the other side that the Eighth Circuit has held the exact opposite of that?
I do not agree with that because the Eighth Circuit has explicitly said that that's an assumption. And other courts have treated that as an assumption too, including the Sixth Circuit, which I think is the most recent court to weigh in on this subject, that in United States versus Rich, 14 Fed 4th, 489, that's a published opinion. It treated the Eighth Circuit's decision as an assumption that we wouldn't be creating a circuit split, and it came out consistently with what I just said, which is there's no reason 1B1.3 wouldn't apply to the stash house enhancement. There's a little bit of a debate, I suppose, because the language of the guideline itself starts with add 2 points if the defendant. That's language that the guidelines use all over the place. Sometimes they use that language, sometimes they use the passive voice. And that's a factor to consider, but the guidelines themselves make pretty clear that that language isn't designed as an exception to relevant conduct principles. For example, in 3C1.3, which is the reckless endangerment during flight, starts the same way, if the defendant creates an unreasonable risk. But the comment says, well, it also applies if he aided and abetted somebody else who created that unreasonable
counsel,
risk.
Could you identify to me where in your brief you argued that he could be held liable for the actions of his co-conspirator under a Pinkerton theory? Your red brief to me is all about what he did and what the evidence showed about him. I didn't see any development of this argument about these cases of the Eighth and the Sixth Circuit and whether he could be held. Where's that in your red brief?
You're 100% right, Your Honor. It's not in my brief. I was trying to answer Judge Richardson's question, but I don't claim that I asserted it in my brief. My omission, however, does not deprive this court of its authority to exercise its discretion to affirm on any ground fairly supported by the record. I do
absolutely
apologize for not writing it.
I have another question about whether I think this, I mean, I know there are a bunch of cases of this court saying this is highly fact-bound. There are cases saying it seems like clear error review. But I guess I'm going to put, what strikes me is this case fundamentally comes down to, on the facts that I understand them, is question. Is actively participating in a drug trafficking conspiracy than a factual question? That strikes me as a question of what does the word maintain mean? But would you like to respond to that?
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, I think there's two parts to it, and one is the point we were just talking about. If this court accepts that relevant conduct principles apply? I think the answer is in almost all cases, yes, if you're participating in a conspiracy and the drug-involved premises are reasonably foreseeable, then you're going to be responsible for that. But separately from
Assume I don't agree with that. So I'd like to hear part two.
I figured that was where your question was headed. The answer, I think it's still a bit fact-specific. The word maintain, I don't know if this court needs to go as far as to say maintain includes all drug conspiracies involving a stash house. But what I think that even the plain language of the term does include is keeping a premises up, keeping its operation productivity. That's Black's Law Dictionary's language. Keeping a place's operation productivity going. It's not just maintaining it in the sense of keeping its physical integrity together or in good repair, but the operation productivity is part of it. And what this court has said in Carbajal and Holloman and a couple of the decisions that the defense has cited is storing drugs at a premises for the purposes of distribution is a kind of maintenance. And I want to maybe it'll help clear something up. The drugs that were found in the residence, and they weren't not Rodney Rose's. Over the mantle, but the drugs he was charged with after the seizure and in the house. So he was storing drugs in the house. And it wasn't just an isolated incident. This is something that went on for at months. Several witnesses testified he's dealing drugs on Calvary Street routinely, all the time. He's at that house with Rodney Rhodes all the time.
Can you respond to your colleague's suggestion that we ought to view, I don't want to unfairly characterize it, but he seems to suggest that it's about what's inside the house, that the premises doesn't include the curtilage, for example, right? And so, and that comes up in some apartment cases because there is no outside, but in a location like this, where there's both an interior and an exterior that is part of that location, can you talk for just a second about whether we ought to limit the analysis to what happens inside the four exterior walls, or whether the premises includes, you know, the picnic table that's right outside, or however we want to describe it?
I think it includes both, and the reason is that the guideline itself talks about also highly relevant, the conduct that he conducted in and around the house, at least insofar as the court can make a reasonable connection. He invited, for example, the informant. This was a transaction arranged by Barnett, according to the informant himself. He said, hey, holler at me. Come back. I got some good drop. And he invited him back to that location. He went back to that location at the premises. And I think defense is correct. I think the transaction occurred outside, immediately adjacent to the premises. But that is an example of the defendant controlling access to or activities at the premises, which is what the commentary asks the court to focus on. And again, not isolated. He's conducting this drug business on Calvary Street, which the premises were at the end of. This was, in the words of the district court, their headquarters. They're using it as their headquarters. The district court inferred from all of this evidence that they were storing drugs there on a regular basis and coming out and dealing drugs on the street. It wasn't just that they happened to come into the same area, but they were using that house as their headquarters. And that is not a
counsel. How much, can I ask you, how much does your argument in this case depend on the fact that Barnett and Rhodes are cousins? Because I'm trying to hypothesize these exact same set of facts where the individuals are not related to each other at all. And I have an intuition that it might make a difference, but I'd like you to articulate that, right? Because it seems very clear this was Rhodes' house. I mean, there's paper with his name on it, right? And you obviously mentioned several times in the brief, can you just talk about whether and to what extent it matters that these individuals are related to each other?
I don't believe it matters in isolation. That's perhaps one of the ways we know that they were working together, but we also have eyewitness testimony that these two were working closely together, that, for example,
assume, to go back to something your colleague was saying, I don't think there's really much doubt that they were working together, but there's, you know, the district court, I agree, the district court said it was their headquarters, which implies to me that there's something akin to partners. But another way to describe it is they're an employer and an employee, and maybe the answer is different, right? I think you could make sense to say that if there are two partners working out of the same place, they're both maintaining that place. If there's a master and a servant, though, I'm not sure we would say the servant is maintaining the place that the person works. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I suppose I disagree with that premise. I do not think that this guideline is designed to draw a hierarchy. There's another specific offense characteristic in guidelines for that, which is a managerial role versus a minor role. But in this case, and to give a couple examples, Clark was one I can think of, and there's a couple other examples where this enhancement was applied to someone who was undisputedly a subordinate in a larger operation. Clark was, I think, the subordinate of a fellow named Freeman. And I do think you can analogize it to an employer-employee relationship. I'm a little reluctant to sort of embrace the formality here because it is a totality of the circumstances kind of thing, but certainly you could say that, for example, the manager of a pizza company, a pizzeria, is maintaining the pizzeria, even if he's not the one with the ownership in the pizzeria, or there's a higher boss.
So I totally get that. Let me give you another example then that maybe helps illustrate what I'm a little concerned about. I think this is genuinely hard. I mean, now imagine that instead of Barnett, imagine there are 10 other people selling drugs out of this house. It's Rhodes' house, and there are 11 people who sell drugs out of this house, and they do all the things that Mr. Barnett did. Is the government's view that every one of those 11 people is maintaining the house?
I think that's a possibility, Your Honor, if you're talking about a situation where every one of them is storing drugs in that house and on a regular basis calling people to come to that house to conduct their drug business.
Well, then it just strikes me that the government is interpreting maintaining as work out of. That maintaining is just a synonym for working out of. Because I don't think it's plausible. Unless maintaining means working out of, it strikes me as hard to say that those 11 individuals are all maintaining the house.
I think the key difference between, I mean, working out of would be significantly harder than this case. Because what Mr. Barnett did was store his drug distribution materials, his scales, his bags, in the house. And in addition to that, conducted his drug transactions in and around the house, and did so for a sustained period of time. It strikes me as a much harder case to say, well, any kind of working out of the house. If they bring their own drugs in their pocket, but maybe they go into the house to use the restroom or get some water or something, but they're working the streets, harder case for us, I think. If you did have some kind of big house where each person's got their own setup selling drugs in a room, I think that's a much fairer case to make, because every one of those people is responsible for converting this piece of property into a drug-involved premises. This is something Congress was particularly concerned with. This guideline was a response to a particular congressional directive in the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. And Congress said, we want to make sure that you get an enhancement for maintaining the kind of premises described in 21 U.S.C. 856, which is a drug-involved premise. And that's a longstanding statute that was focused on the damage to property and the damage to the neighborhood by making a house into a drug premises. And when you have, if everyone were doing that, I think they would all be equally responsible, at least as responsible as the person who perhaps wasn't doing that but had a key to the place and just let them do it. So I suppose that's my answer. I don't think the court needs to go as far as saying any drug house someone's working out of, but I think this case makes it a little bit easier. It is one he ran into in response to the police. It is one he was working out of regularly. He was a very close a close associate and someone who was working with the person who it's conceded was maintaining the house. And he stored his drugs and drug supplies there. So I think this court can affirm the decision of the district court and ought to, both because of Mr. Barnett's conduct directly and through the principles of relevant conduct. And if this panel has no further questions, I will yield the balance of my time back to the court.
You got some time on reply, counsel?
Thank you. I want to start by saying that the guideline and the application notes say manufacture or distribution or storage for subsequent distribution. There's no evidence that Keith Barnett sold or distributed drugs that had previously been inside that house. There's no evidence that he manufactured drugs inside that house. There is some evidence, and that was this district attorney's testimony from state who had prosecuted Mr. Barnett in state court. He came into the federal case and said, hey, I was there the day he made his first appearance in state court. And he told the judge he takes responsibility for the drugs. They're not Mr. Rhodes's drugs. However, it's unclear what drugs he's talking about. And the defense counsel asked him, he said, how do you remember this? And the district attorney said, I remember it because he was charged with trafficking in cocaine. But Keith Barnett was not charged with trafficking in cocaine. The record lists what he was charged with that day. It's on, it's in volume two of the supplemental joint appendix, page 466. There's a paragraph 67 there, lists the eight charges that he had that day from state court. None of them are trafficking in cocaine. There are three trafficking in heroin charges. To get trafficking in heroin in North Carolina, you got to have at least 4 grams of heroin. To get trafficking in cocaine in North Carolina, you got to have 28 grams of cocaine. The drugs that were found in that yard were half a gram of cocaine and 8 grams of heroin. So was Keith Barnett talking about the drugs found in the yard, or was he talking about the drugs found in the house when he says, I take responsibility for the drugs, they're not Rodney Rhodes's drugs? It's unclear from the district attorney's testimony as he's saying this. So
do we get to do that? I mean, the district court found that it applied. And it seems like to me in that context, I mean, you know, all right, even if you have a way to question the credibility of some evidence, we typically take the evidence in the light most favorable to the district court's ruling in this context, right? We don't go
yeah,
back.
Yeah, there's it's a deferential standard. And it has to be clear error. But again, my argument's an insufficient evidence argument. There's not a lot of evidence that puts Keith Barnett's activities inside that house. And so the guideline says manufacture, distribute, or store for distribution. For all we know, Keith Barnett brought his own drugs to the house. Rodney Rhodes let him sell drugs outside the house. And that was Keith Barnett's role with respect to that. And so if you're going to say, well, the premises enhancement applies to Barnett, you're going to have to base it on the language in the application note that says at the premises and not necessarily inside the premises, because the evidence was that Barnett was this employee type guy who was allowed to sell drugs outside the house, not that he was an integral part of what went on inside the house. And that's the bottom line. So I ask you to rule in favor of Mr. Barnett and strike the enhancement and return it to the district court for resentencing. Thank you.
Well, we certainly appreciate your argument and note that you're court appointed, and I certainly appreciate you continuing to take that and doing your characteristically excellent job of representing your client. We would love to come down and greet you as always. Unfortunately, we can't do that. But we look forward to doing it in the future. And thank you for your service. With that, we'll ask court to close the in court for the day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning. God save the United States and its.
Due to technical difficulties, there are unrecorded portions of this oral argument.